Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Serial Killer Tuesdays, Season 2. Let's address the elephant in the room. I've been gone a long time. Life happens, as I'm sure most of you can understand. This whole time I've been gone, I've been horribly, horribly depressed. I didn't realize how much this podcast affected my life until I stopped doing it for a while. They say never turn your hobby into a job, so moving forward, I'm going to do just that. Keep this podcast as a little slice of heaven to keep my mind occupied. For season 2, I will be putting out episodes every 2 weeks instead of every week. I'm hoping this adjustment in the upload schedule will give me a little bit more breathing room and be able to get episodes out to you more consistently instead of taking weeks upon weeks to get something out to you. And of course, every episode will be up on Tuesdays because what would be the point of calling it Serial Killer Tuesdays? I just want to say thank you to all my serial supporters who patiently waited for my return. I love you all so much. But, like any good serial killer, I've had my cooldown period, and now it's back to the fun. As you may know, at the end of each episode every week, I like to give my favorite podcast a shout out, so make sure you stay until the end for that. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at SKT Podcast to keep up to date on everything podcast related. Want to help support the show? All it would take is the price of a single cup of coffee. I know a lot of people can't financially afford a monthly subscription to Patreon or something like that. A one-time donation is so much easier, and it comes with perks. If you graciously decide my podcast is one worth supporting, you can request any serial killer, cult leader, hitman, whatever you prefer, to be discussed on this show. And or if you have a podcast or a YouTube channel yourself, I will give you an exclusive shout out on my podcast. I'll also leave you a rating, review, comment, and I'll subscribe. It's the least I can do. Check out buymeacoffee.com/SKTpodcast to buy me a cup of liquid energy. But never feel obligated to do so. Just the fact that you tune in is always enough for me. Tonight, we will be looking at the boarding house killer, Dorothea Puente, and the slave master, John Edward Robinson. I kept these two killers a secret from my listeners simply to generate hype. I guess 7 months worth of hype is worth it, right? Well, I don't really think so, but you can be the judge of that. I finally have the episode out and ready for you all to enjoy. As always, what you're about to hear may be graphic and disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. There is something that feels so innocent when it comes to the elderly. They almost come off as children, until we are reminded that they've already lived through everything we're experiencing now. Without smartphones, of course. I can't really wrap my head around the notion that the elderly could be capable of anything other than amazing hugs and delicious homemade food. I just always picture my grandparents, whose face light up when I stop by for a visit, or would spoil me rotten at the dismay of my parents. This case is one I didn't want to believe when I first read about it. It was like I was reading about my own grandma on trial for murder. I always feel some level of sympathy for the killers I talk about, but this one feels a little more intense. Was she really that desperate that she felt her only way to get ahead was murder, or was the money she gained from murdering her own tenants just a bonus to the carnage she inflicted upon the innocent? It's such a morbid way to look at an old woman, but the facts don't lie. Despite being older than most of the evil beings I talk about, her body count speaks for itself. Tonight, I present the boarding house killer, Dorothea Puente. Dorothea Puente was born on January 9, 1929, in Redlands, California. Like most serial killers, Dorothea was born into a life of great pain and anguish. Both her mother and her father were severe alcoholics who never shied away from putting Dorothea right in the middle of traumatic experiences. Her mother was a sex worker, and her father attempted suicide in front of her at an incredibly early age. In 1937, at only 4 years old, her father died of tuberculosis, and when she was seven, her mother had perished in a fatal car accident. Not long after, she was sent to live in an orphanage where she was repeatedly sexually abused. Desperate to escape the orphanage, in 1945, at 16 years old, she ran away and married a soldier named Fred McFall when he returned from World War II. Between 1946 and 1948, Dorothea became pregnant with two daughters. One she sent to live with family in Sacramento, and the other she placed up for adoption. After suffering a miscarriage in late 1948, McFall ended the marriage. Her criminal history began some time after her divorce. She was sentenced to a year in prison for forging checks, but was paroled after only serving 6 months. Not long after returning home, she became pregnant by a man she barely knew. After giving birth to her daughter, she quickly gave the little girl up for adoption. In 1952, she remarried to a man named Axel Johansson, which began a tumultuous 14-year marriage. Dorothea continued her criminal career throughout the 60s. She was arrested for owning and managing an illegal brothel and was sentenced to 3 months in Sacramento County Jail. Shortly after her release, she was once again arrested and sentenced to another 3 months stint in jail for vagrancy. Over time, her crimes gradually became more and more serious. Dorothea found work as a nurse's aide, caring for the elderly in private homes, and eventually began running her own boarding houses. In 1966, she was yet again divorced and remarried for a third time, this time to Robert Puente, a man almost two decades younger than her. This marriage rapidly fell apart, and Dorothea was divorced for a third time after being with Robert for only 2 years. After the marriage ended, Dorothea took over a three-story, 16-bedroom care home at 2100 F Street in Sacramento. In 1976, she was married for a fourth time, this time to Pedro Montalvo. This man was a violent alcoholic, and the marriage only lasted a few months. At this point, Dorothea wasn't looking for her happily ever after. She would frequent local bars looking for men and ultimately steal all that they were worth. This led Dorothea to be charged with 34 counts of treasury fraud, which only hit her with probation. Dorothea's murder spree began not long after gaining the F Street boarding house, mostly when she started renting the top floor apartment in the three-story building to elderly tenants. While her reputation on F Street was mixed, her financial gain was something she hailed over everything else. Police speculated Dorothea was profiting more than $5,000 every month. In April of 1982, Dorothea rented out the apartment to 61-year-old Ruth Monroe. Soon after moving in, Ruth was found dead in her apartment due to an overdose of codeine and acetaminophen. My sister's going to be very mad that I had to take a second to remember how to pronounce that word. She's a nurse, in case y'all wanted to know. Dorothea told police that she was very depressed because she was told her husband was terminally ill. Ruth's death was ruled as a suicide. After a few weeks, police returned to F Street and spoke to Malcolm McKenzie, who accused Dorothea of drugging him and stealing his money. Dorothea was arrested and charged and convicted on 3 counts of theft in August of 1982. She was sentenced to 5 years in prison, but only served 3 and was released in 1985. While in prison, she struck up a romance with 77-year-old pen pal Everson Gilmouth, who, when she was released, Gilmouth picked her up in his 1980 red Ford pickup truck, and the two began making wedding plans. The same year, Dorothea hired Ismael Flores to install wood paneling in her apartment. In addition to paying the man $800 for his work, she gifted him with a red 1980 Ford pickup and claimed it was her boyfriend's who had been living in Los Angeles and no longer has a need for it. After doing work around her apartment, Dorothea asked Ismail if he could build her a 6x3x2 foot box so she could, in her own words, store books and other items. Ismail made the box, and after Dorothea filled it up and nailed it shut, she joined Ismail on the trip to transport it to a storage depot she had been renting. Along the way, she asked Ismail to pull over off the highway in Sutter County and dump the box along the riverbank. She claimed it was only filled with junk. On January 1st, 1986, a fisherman spotted the box and informed police. When the investigators arrived on scene, they opened the box and were greeted to a badly decomposed body of an unidentified elderly man. When police tried to unravel the mystery of the man in the box, Dorothea happily collected Everson Gilmouth's pension checks and wrote letters to his family explaining that Everson stopped contacting them because he was ill. It took 3 years for police to identify the body found in the box along the river. It was, in fact, Everson Gilmouth. Dorothea maintained her room and board business and accepted 40 new tenants. Dorothea was praised by social workers for accepting tough cases, which included drug addicts and abusive elderly tenants. What she kept hidden was the fact that she collected their monthly mail before they could see it, gave the tenants stipends, and pocketed the rest of the money for herself, claiming it was for expenses. During this time, parole officers frequented the boarding house. Dorothea had previously been ordered to stay away from the elderly and was not allowed to handle any government-issued checks. No less than 15 visits were made to the house. No violations had ever been documented. Suspicion of wrongdoing was first noted by neighbors noticing odd activity at Dorothea's boarding house. She had adopted a homeless alcoholic known to locals as Chief and employed him as the house's handyman. Neighbors watched as Dorothea would have Chief dig out the basement and haul away debris in a wheelbarrow. She had Chief rebuild the concrete slab that was once the basement floor, and shortly after the floor had been laid, Chief disappeared. On November 11, 1988, police were called to investigate the disappearance of Alberto Montoya, a developmentally disabled man with schizophrenia who was a tenant on F Street. His social worker had reported him missing. Investigators had noticed some disturbed soil on the property and, after digging it up, discovered the body of 78-year-old Liana Carpenter. Eventually, investigators turned up 7 more bodies on the property. During the investigation, Dorothea was not initially considered as a suspect. She could leave the property to grab a cup of coffee from a nearby hotel. However, she instead fled to Los Angeles and befriended an elderly man whom she met in a bar. The man in the bar recognized her from police reports on the TV and immediately contacted police right after their encounter. She was arrested and her trial began in October of 1992, lasting almost a year. Prosecution called 130 witnesses and argued that Dorothea would drug her tenants with sleeping pills, suffocate them, then hire convicts to dig the holes where she disposed of the bodies. Dorothea was charged with 9 murders, her boyfriend, Everson Gilmouth, 77, and 8 tenants who lived at the boarding house, Ruth Monroe, 61, Liana Carpenter, 78, Alvaro, Bert, or Alberto, Gonzalez Montoya, 51, Dorothea Miller, 64, Benjamin Fink, 55, James Gallup, 62, Vera Faye Martin, 64, and Betty Palmer, 78. It took the jury a month to deliberate and found Dorothea Puente guilty on 3 out of the 9 counts of murder. She was sentenced to 2 life sentences without the possibility of parole. While serving her sentence, Dorothea died of natural causes in 2011. She was 82 years old. While doing my research into this subject, I came across many, many pictures from Dorothea's trial. What disturbed me the most was the lack of remorse she had on her face the entire time. I know most serial killers are never exactly remorseful or empathetic toward their victims and their families, but this was something else. A little old lady showing no emotion as accusations of murder are wildly thrown around a courtroom is very unsettling. When most people imagine a serial killer, their first thought doesn't land on an elderly lady. It's just one of those things where we have almost an unspoken set of rules and guidelines for how other people should look, act, feel, and think, but I believe this case just proves there's always an exception to the rule. The next killer on my roster for the evening may very well be the first of his kind. Long gone are the days of AOL and MySpace. Now we have other mind-numbing platforms such as TikTok and Snapchat. When I was growing up, Instant Messenger and anonymous online chat rooms were the places to be. I'm perfectly aware this makes me sound ancient to the younger listeners I may have, but hey, I'm just a sad, depressed millennial fueled by dusty, crusty nostalgia. Don't hate the player, hate the game. Unfortunately, not all that glitters is gold. One man took advantage of this anonymity and used it to act upon his wildest, morbid fantasies. This is the man your parents warned you about when the internet was new, scary, and uncharted territory. Often referred to as the internet's first serial killer, I present the slave master, John Edward Robinson. John Edward Robinson was born on December 27, 1943, in Cicero, Illinois. He was the third of five children born to an alcoholic father and disciplinarian mother. In 1957, John became an Eagle Scout and was sent with another group of young Eagle Scouts to perform for the Queen in London, and was later enrolled into an all-boys private school with aspirations of becoming a priest. However, due to disciplinary issues, John left after only 1 year. John decided he wanted to become an X-ray technician and enrolled at Morton Junior College in 1961. He only made it through 2 years before deciding to drop out. 3 years after moving to Kansas, John met his wife, Nancy. They went on to have four children together by 1971. While not much else is known about his past, we do know that his criminal career began back in 1969, first starting with embezzlement. He used fake credentials to gain employment as an X-ray technician, and while he was there, he stole about $33,000. He was convicted and sentenced to 3 years probation. He soon violated that probation by moving to Chicago without permission and began working as an insurance salesman. In 1971, he was once again in trouble for embezzlement and was sent back to Kansas to finish his probation, which was subsequently extended due to his new embezzlement charge. In 1975, he found himself yet again on the wrong side of the law and was arrested for securities and mail fraud for setting up a fake medical consulting company. His probation was extended for a third time. All the while, John was portraying himself as an upstanding family man and valuable member of society. He was soon able to con his way onto the board of directors of a charity and forged a letter from the Kansas City mayor claiming that he was a wonderful volunteer and devoted member of his community. Even though his probation had finally come to an end in 1979, his fraud and forgery habits never seemed to end. In 1980, he was arrested for check forgery and embezzlement and was sentenced to 60 days in jail, a sentence not carried out until 1982. Upon his release, he created a fake company and swindled his friend out of $25,000, claiming he could turn a quick profit to help pay for that friend's dying wife's medical expenses. While all this was happening, John was becoming more problematic within his neighborhood. He was constantly propositioning the wives of his neighbors for sex, so much so that this led to a physical altercation between himself and his neighbor's husband. He later claimed he had joined a sadomasochistic cult called the Internal Council of Masters. He stated that he was the slave master, and it was his duty to lure in females to be raped and tortured. By this point, his focus was rapidly shifting from financial gain to violent fantasy. While John is believed to be the internet's first serial killer, he did not start out this way. His first victim was 19-year-old Paula Godfrey, who was hired to work as a sales representative for one of John's fake companies. He told everyone that he sent her away to complete training and was never heard from again. She was reported missing by her parents, but several days later, they received a typed letter supposedly written by Paula, saying that she was fine and didn't want to have any contact. In 1985, John met 19-year-old Lisa Stacy at a battered woman's shelter. He promised her a job, somewhere to live, and daycare for her 4-month-old daughter. He made Lisa sign several sheets of blank paper, and after a few days, John contacted his brother and sister-in-law, asking if they wanted to adopt a baby girl since her mother committed suicide. Unable to adopt through the normal process, his brother and sister-in-law took him up on his offer and adopted the 4-month-old that they eventually named Heather. John requested $5,000 for legal fees and forged adoption papers for the new parents to sign. Lisa was never heard from again. John's next murder came in June of 1987. He met 27-year-old Catherine Clampett, who moved to Kansas City to find work. John offered her a job and told her she would be getting wardrobe and travel allowances. She disappeared and was never seen or heard from afterward. After this, John was incarcerated on several fraud charges in both Kansas and Missouri. He was released from prison in 1993, but while there, he met 49-year-old Beverly Bonner, the prison librarian, who left her husband and began working for John. He then arranged Beverly's alimony checks to be sent to a Kansas post office box. And much like his other victims, no one ever saw Beverly again. In 1994, John discovered what would be his new hunting grounds in the form of anonymous online BDSM chat rooms. This is how he was introduced to 45-year-old Sheila Faith and told him all about her wheelchair-bound daughter, 15-year-old Debbie. John posed as a wealthy businessman and promised to take care of Sheila's daughter's medical expenses if she agreed to come work for him. Sheila and Debbie moved from California all the way to Kansas. Soon after arriving, they both vanished. For 7 years afterward, John would cash Sheila's pension checks. For years, John became very well known in popular online BDSM chat rooms. In 1999, he offered a job and bondage relationship to 21-year-old Elizabeth Lewicka, a Polish immigrant living in Indiana. Although he was still married to Nancy, after Isabella moved to Kansas City, John gave Isabella an engagement ring. They both went to the county registrar where they paid for a marriage certificate but never picked it up. She signed a 115-page slave contract giving John complete control over every aspect of her life, including giving him control over all of her bank accounts. During that same year, Isabella disappeared, and when speaking to a web designer he had employed, John said that she had been deported for getting caught smoking marijuana. Around the time of Isabella's disappearance, 28-year-old nurse Suzette Troughton moved from Michigan to Kansas to travel the world with John as his personal sex slave. Suzette's mother received several typed and signed letters from Suzette, to which her mother said that they were uncharacteristically void of any grammatical errors. John later told Suzette's mother that she had run away with an acquaintance and stole a large sum of money from him. As time went on, John became increasingly sloppy with the way he would cover his tracks. Authorities began to suspect John was behind several missing persons cases that popped up both in Kansas and Missouri. John was arrested in June of 2000 after a woman filed a sexual battery case against him, and police also filed theft charges against him for stealing this woman's sex toys. With this charge, police had probable cause to gain a search warrant. While executing the search on John's farm in Lacine, Kansas, investigators found the decomposing remains of Isabella Lewicka and Suzette Troughton in two 85-pound chemical drums. In Missouri, investigators also searched two large storage garages rented out by John. There, they found three corpses in similar chemical drums. The bodies were later identified as Beverly Bonner, Sheila Faith, and her daughter, Debbie. All five women were killed by blunt force trauma to the head. In 2002, Robinson stood trial in Kansas for the murders of Suzette Troughton, Isabella Lewicka, and Lisa Stacy. After a lengthy trial, John was convicted on all counts. He received a death penalty for the murders of Suzette and Isabella, and a life sentence for the murder of Lisa. He did not receive a death sentence for her murder because she was killed before Kansas had reinstated the death penalty. He also received a 5 to 20 year prison sentence for interfering with the parental custody of Lisa's daughter, 20 and a half years for kidnapping, and 7 months for theft. After he was convicted in Kansas, John was sent to Missouri to face more murder charges based on the evidence found in that state. John's lawyers were anxious to face trial in Missouri, knowing that they were far more aggressive toward getting a capital punishment conviction. The prosecutor would not accept any plea deal unless John led investigators to the bodies of Lisa Stacy, Paula Gottfried, and Catherine Clampett. John refused, but eventually acknowledged that the prosecution had more than enough evidence to convict him of capital murder, which entered him into a guilty plea in October of 2003. He received a life sentence without the possibility of parole for each murder. In November of 2015, the Kansas Supreme Court vacated two of John's death sentences, both on technicalities, but still upheld Isabella Lewick's murder conviction and its accompanying death sentence. In 2006, a young woman's body was discovered in a barrel in rural Iowa, a place that, reportedly, John had a business partner. Forensic experts concluded that this body had been in that barrel for about 2 decades, and investigators believed that John Edward Robinson was involved somehow. Police note that there are several years unaccounted for during John's reign of terror that he may be responsible for other murders that have yet to be discovered. John Edward Robinson is currently 76 years old, awaiting execution at the El Dorado Correctional Facility in Kansas. I would like to welcome you all to my final segment of the evening. I call this the Missing Persons Report, where I visit the FBI website and share a few missing persons cases with my listeners. I feel like it's my duty as a serial killer / true crime podcast to get this important information out there. Maybe we can help bring these lost souls home. My first case of the evening, Lori Boffman, may also go by Lori Stubbs. Date of birth, June 6th, 1961, would be approximately 60 years old today. Eye color, brown. Height, 5 foot 9 inches at the time of her disappearance. Weight, 180 pounds approximately at the time of her disappearance. Sex, female. Race, black. Marks and scars. Lori was often seen wearing glasses and has a scar on her abdomen. Lori Boffman was last seen on August 5th, 2006 at 6:30 p.m. When she left her home and took a drive in her vehicle, she did not take her purse or identification with her. Additionally, Lori was taking medication for diabetes. Her vehicle was found the next morning at 5:30 a.m. in the next town over from her home. She resided in Liberty Township, Ohio, and the vehicle was found in Youngstown, Ohio. the vehicle appeared to have been in an accident and was abandoned. Lori Boffman has not been seen or heard from since this incident. If you or anyone you know has information concerning this case, you are encouraged to call the Cleveland FBI field office at 216-552-1400. Thank you. My second case of the evening, Matthew Henry. Date of birth, September 2nd, 1988. He would be approximately 33 years old today. Eye color, hazel. Height, 5 foot 8 inches to 5 foot 9 inches, approximately, at the time of his disappearance. Weight, 160 to 180 pounds approximately at the time of his disappearance. Weight, race, white. Marks and scars. Matthew has tattoos on his chest, his upper left arm, and his entire right arm. Matthew Henry has previously resided in Dunlap, Tennessee. He is known to have frequented Marion County, Bledsoe County, White County, Van Buren County, and Hamilton County in Tennessee. He has also frequented Dalton, Atlanta, and Albany, Georgia. Matthew was last seen wearing his facial hair in a full beard and was last seen on April 15, 2018 in Dunlap, Tennessee. He was reported missing on April 27, 2018 and has not been seen or heard from since. If you or anyone you know has any information concerning this case, you are encouraged to call the Knoxville FBI field office at 865-544-0715. Thank you. Well, human friends, that is all I have for you this evening. Yeah, I know I was a little bit shaky, but let me tell you one thing. When you're doing a podcast and you don't want to start over a billion times, that's me. That's my life. I'm constantly starting over. I didn't want to do that. So forgive me if I'm a little shaky and have to repeat myself a couple of times. But, you know, we're all human, right? That's why I always call you my human friends. So, you know, forgive me. It's been 7 months. I don't know what you want from me. It feels so good to be back. I miss this podcast more than you could ever know. I only wish I would have come back sooner. I really do appreciate all of your love, support, and patience. And now it's time for the best part of my podcast, shouting out other podcasts that I know you will really enjoy. This week's shoutouts go to Weird Distractions Podcast at Weird Distractee 1, Curious Nixon's Podcast at Curious Nixon's, and the Paranormal Burrito Podcast at TBD Pod. Make sure you go check them out, follow them on Twitter, leave them a rating, review, and let them know I sent you. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at SKT Podcast so you don't miss anything podcast related. If you can, consider buying me a cup of coffee at buymeacoffee.com/SKT Podcast. All the money will go toward making a better show for you all to enjoy. I'm even hoping to get to a point where I can take that money every month and donate it back to charities that I believe in. That's something I've always wanted to do. But, as I said before, never feel obligated to do it. Your listenership is more than enough for me. On the next episode, I did have two killers in mind. They were voted by my followers on Twitter and Instagram. However, I do recognize that it is Pride Month, and I decided to swap them out for two killers that terrorize the LGBT plus community. They deserve to have their stories heard just as much as us, so I've decided to go with Bruce MacArthur and the Black Doodler, who has never been caught. So stay tuned for that. I really appreciate it. The killers that Twitter and Instagram voted for will be making a return, but that'll be for season 2, episode 3. It's gonna be a hell of a ride, so don't miss it. Good night, and stay safe.